Hey.
Hello, Molly.
Hello, Josh. Thank you for joining us on Untalented. The next episode. I think probably the easiest way to ease us into this is a this or that.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready?
I certainly am. Yeah, let's
okay,
go for it.
Born ready. Thinking or doing?
Oh, fuck. I love both. That's not a viable answer, is it?
Nope.
Okay, because it's today, I'm going to say thinking.
Okay. Data-driven or intuition-led?
Intuition-led.
Nice, that one was on the money straight there. Timeless or trendy?
I think timelessness, actually, because at the end of the day, trends are cyclical as well.
Yeah.
And a trend becomes timeless if mm-hmm. you wait long enough, because it comes back timeless.
Nailed that
But
one.
I love things that are new.
Yeah.
Don't we all? Hmm? But I love things that are new, and don't we all?
Yeah, right? Exactly. Mm. Craft or art?
Oh gosh, these are really like
really getting you these.
Yeah, I mean, it should be art, because that's the higher order thing that craft contributes to, art. But there's all the joy is in the craft sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Art, craft in service of art. Art.
Barbie or Ken?
Ken, I think.
Sweet or savory?
Savory.
Talk to animals or talk every language?
Talk every language.
Oh, I think mm-hmm. I would have gone animals, but mm-hmm. I'm a weird animal girl, so.
I'm allergic to so many animals.
Oh, fair. So you want to be as far away as them as possible.
Yeah.
Photos or videos?
Oh, I love both. That's not a viable answer, is it? I love videos. It's kind of my job, but I've got this obsession with photography and the breadth of it and the singularity of it and my constant annoyance is I can't get to bring enough of that into the world of advertising. You know, mm-hmm. The sphere is quite narrow, and I just look at photography all the time. Photography.
Nice. You'll be pleased to know that's over. that section's done. But I think as well, one of the main questions that we start this with to really get things moving is, who was the first person that made you feel talented?
My English teacher in school when I was aged 9 years old, he was called Mr. Lin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me more about Mr. Lin.
It's a hazy memory, but I think that's probably the first person. I mean, he was just really interested in us and our imagination, as opposed to just making us read a book and tick a box, mm-hmm. you know? And he really, really inspired me. And I know that was the case because he left the school. And even as a small child, that kind of saddened me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that it left some kind of momentary, you know, inspirational human type void in my life, and I'd never experienced that before, you know. So I guess that was that. An English teacher, very, very early doors. And I guess really, here we are 40 odd years later, and I'm still writing, so it must have planted some kind of positive little kernel of something at that point in time.
Yeah, I think it's always so important at school at such a young age to have people such as that who just want to explore your curiosity in something, rather than forcing it on you or making it seem something that you dread. It's actually just have fun with it and be open with it and be curious about it, and then you said, you never know where that can sort of lead you with it.
And I remember he was different to my other teachers at the time, because he met us all on a level, you know. He encouraged us to come up a little bit and be a bit more intellectually mature,
mm-hmm.
but he also stepped down a little bit as well and broke that barrier of authority between, you know, student and teacher. That was super rare back then,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? I feel like school, I've got kids now, and my daughter's school is so right on and, you know, progressive compared to...
Yeah.
You know, back in the day. I think that was quite a unique behavior back then, to sort of, you know, step outside of the kind of preordained structures of, you know,
mm-hmm.
who's the boss and who isn't and that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
I think that really, And I haven't thought about this since I was at primary school, so it obviously really made a mark. And now you've made me think about why, and I think that's why. You know, he broke the rules, and he broke the barriers, and he met us on a level, and he took an interest in what we did.
Sweet, nice. I think obviously from school, you then started, I think I was curious to like explore more about you starting in the industry in production and as a producer, obviously quite different to where you are now, but like what was that journey like? How was it starting as a producer to now being ECD and founder of Calling?
Yeah, it's been a meandering journey. I think I've been lucky, and I've been lucky that it's been meandering, but it's also been a bit of hard work. Like, I started in probably my first job was like 1990, real job, like 1997 or something like that. And I was kind of unemployed, pretty poor. Dole wasn't very much back then. And, you know, I took a course in publishing at the local technical college that you could get free back then, because if you were unemployed. And it taught you all this kind of stuff like bookbinding and developing black and white negatives and, you know, all that Quark Express and all that shit. But they also had a library that was connected to the internet, like back in the day, and a person that could teach you Photoshop and HTML. And like, I went and I learned that, and it turned into my first job, which was like in design and code. Like, okay. I started in design, like web design basically, in a digital agency. And then did that for a while, accidentally ended up kind of starting a business with a friend in the dot-com crash.
Right.
If anyone remembers that, in like the year 2000, when all the dot-com businesses burst and like literally nobody had a job for a bit. It was like super weird. And there's a meme going around of like an early version of a hipster holding a placard saying, "We'll code HTML for food." And that was kind of the jam for like about a year. And everyone's like, "What the fuck? We had an industry and then we didn't." And it really did come and go.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. It was a weird old time. So we kind of like were two people in the same kind of line of work, and we started together, and we started, you know, like developing, designing all that stuff, but for ourselves, because, you know, we didn't have jobs. And then that just turned into a business, and then we started running it, and then that became more of a job in production. And then the rest are kind of like history, really. It was a very sort of prototype version of, you know, like a digital production company. And I then kind of moved out of that and into bigger, better, more sophisticated versions of that, like digital production at Work Club when they started. And then I went to run Stink Digital. And then off the back of that, I did a really big job with BBH, which was really cool, for ASOS. And they hired me there as their head of interactive. And I think that was the stopping point for me, where I was like, I really have swum around in production now for like about, I don't know, however many years, like a lot. And I'd run a really good production company, and I was running a really great interactive team at, you know, what was at that point, you know, the best agency in town, BBH, 2011, 2012. It was like really, really at the top of its game back then. And I was like, I don't know what this is teaching me anymore, you know? And I felt like I'd run out of gas, and I felt like I wasn't learning anymore. And that's the thing for me. I feel like if I run out of things to learn, then I really have to pivot.
Yeah.
And I was like super fortunate enough to have an amazing relationship with Nick Gill, who was the ECD there at the time. And he was, you know, bemoaning the fact that the agency couldn't crack like social or digital or anything other than above the line work. And I was like, you shouldn't feel bad about this, Nick. It's like, it's the way the agency's been designed, and it's a brilliantly designed machine to make the things that it makes, and it's the best in town. And, you know, it's not the agency's fault. You just need people in here, if you really want to do it, that are going to aggressively or focused in a focused manner go after that kind of work. And so he let me start writing, and I was like, what?
I bet you regretted that at first, and been like, oh God, I'm not prepared for this.
I felt imposter syndrome for sure, but I was really excited, you know, and because, you know, like, you know, at the top of production, especially a production company, you're writing treatments and you're taking the seeds of things that are ill-formed.
Yeah.
And really thinking them through and thinking of a narrative for it and thinking of a visual expression for it. And you know, I've always kind of really swum around just on a personal level as much as possible in, you know, art and culture. I love it, and music, and so bringing all that into the work as well. It's what people expect of a production company, and having done that for so long at Stink, and then bringing that into an ad agency and saying, well, you know, like, there's different ways to express ideas here.
Mm.
It was just such an amazing kind of door that he opened. And to him, it was just like, well, you should do it. And he couldn't see any reason why not. And I don't know. And at that point, I was like, this feels like I'm really, you know, using the full gamut of my intellect and imagination.
Mm.
I was just really, I just knew at that moment that like one door must close here because, you know, I've had an amazing experience, you know, in this industry, you know, like making things and leading teams and, you know, being right at the craft end of things. But, you know, but I feel like I've got to grips with it now and what's mm-hmm. next. And that was about, I guess, 10 years ago now, you know, since then I've been, you know, I was like, I'm going to figure out how to do writing for a living and kind of got my show on the road, really.
Yeah, rest is history. It's mad to think that you were having that conversation 10 years ago and the conversation is still so relevant now.
Yeah.
like the big traditional agency saying, wait a minute, how the hell do we crack social and digital? Like, it seems to have been so much progress, but then also like frozen in time at the same time.
Yeah, I guess in a way. And do you know what? I've really gone back the other way. I started intuitively doing the things that they all found impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I remember the first time someone asked me to write a TV script. I'm like, I can't. And then someone went, you can. And I did.
Yeah.
And then I was like, right, I need to do this. Yeah, you know, I need to figure that out. I need to figure out how to make art direct a good poster and all of that. And, you know, maybe it was easier doing it the wrong way around. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I think the problem that exists, Molly, is, you know, it's in the DNA of a lot of these businesses.
Yeah.
They're all kind of incepted in the 70s or 80s or 90s. And, you know, they're very good at doing what they do. And it is quite hard to change the muscle memory, you know, and especially the people change. But a lot of these businesses still revere the founders. You know, if you go into Wydens, then there's artifacts everywhere, all over the place that are there because Dan Wyden said them or you know, they're anecdotes or folklore from the past that have become the DNA and the principles and the philosophy and the isms of that organization, and the past is kind of revered in a lot of ways. And it is quite hard to just kind of flip and do a completely different thing. Or, you know, I think the question is, it's not one or the other. It's how do you come out of the gates being almost agnostic of medium and going like, you know, we're just going to look at the world and respond in a way that feels right, as opposed to use the tools that we've always used to create the format that we've always created.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you're never going to change anything if you're not actively pushing for that change and letting the change happen and letting like those sort of old school rule books be like torn up a little bit and then kind of glued back together in a different way. And then you kind of pivoted into the more creative director lean, but I noticed as well that there was also always an element of innovation and tech. Is that something, like, again, was that on purpose, or how did you sort of stumble into the more innovation side of things?
Yeah, it comes from where I started. You know, like, I was born into the internet, you know, like that was really my first ever kind of career. You know, the foundations of my career, you know, like shy of, you know, shit jobs before that for minimum wage and whatnot. So it's always something that I felt, you know, really interested in. I think, like, you know, actually, really and truly, you know, these days we have less and less opportunity for true tech innovation. And I feel like the platforms, Facebook, Meta, or whatever, Google, you know, they've kind of killed that off. Because there's not many experiences left on the internet. There's some platforms and there's a couple of news sites. And once upon a time, there used to be hundreds of websites that small humans just made or brands made that people want to visit and have an experience there or learn something there or connect there or what have you. And it was this weird and wonderful utopia back in the day, you know, Tim Berners-Lee and all that. And really now I feel that digital has become so monopolized into a few small, you know, small pockets with huge platforms. And actually, if you're not actually working in one of those places, and probably working in one of those places in the, you know, engineering or development team, this innovation thing has become harder and harder, you know, and I feel now like I've much more pointed myself at, you know, the media that we can affect, you know, like within advertising, you know, like all the things, film, social, digital, you know, out of home. And instead of look at actual tech innovation, which, you know, I feel our industry can affect less and less because it's become more and more the domain of a platform. I feel the innovative thing to do is to just be looking at the things that are our stock in trade and go, what's next? What's the next iteration of a television commercial? What's the next iteration of, you know, an Instagram takeover campaign? What's the next iteration of a billboard, you know? And to push at, you know, the sort of horizon of our industry. And I think it's a shame in a way, like it was a fun time to play with technology, I think 15 years ago. And I think slowly but surely the screw has been turned on the internet. You know what I mean? And it's less of a free for all.
Yeah.
And it's more, this bit's owned by Facebook, that bit's owned by Amazon, that bit's owned by Google, the end.
Yeah, so right? True. And it's so mainstream now as well.
Yeah, for real.
It's like, what can you do that someone in like their late teens, early 20s, who's obsessed with tech cannot do, like type of thing. So I think it's so accessible and so mainstream that actually, like you said, it makes sense to lean back into craft and like back into that marriage of like the art of craft, going right back to our this or that. So that was a good full circle moment.
But to push it on, you know,
to
look at the classic formats and ask yourself what the world wants of it now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sweet. And then we have to mention, obviously, your time at Uncommon.
Yeah.
You were there for 5 years, I want to say.
Yeah,
5 years. One of the first CDs over there. Tell us about that. Everyone will be absolutely dying to know.
Oh, gosh. Uncommon was an amazing, amazing half decade for all of us. You know, I think it was a beautiful marriage, right? I've been out of agency world for a couple of years. I've been client side for a bit. I've been at Vice. I mean, doing my job, but out of ad agencies, I felt quite disillusioned with them after the last place I've been. You know, no need to get into it, but you know, fatigued with it. And you know, I was introduced to Nils by a really good friend. They were like, "You should really meet Nils. Like, Nils would really like to meet people like you, people that think differently." Blah blah blah. I'm like, "Yeah, okay." Blah blah blah. And I went and met him, and you know, I don't know. It was a funny old meeting. Like, I'm sure you're super nice. I've heard you're super nice. I know you're super talented, but I just think this is a waste of time. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. I've been out the ad game, mate. You know, and because I kind of hate it, I'm kind of sick of it. I don't want to be doing this infinite growth capitalism in a world of finite resources anymore. I can't put my head on a pillow. I've got a daughter now, it weighs on me. Oh, kind of people grind on me a bit, you know, all of that stuff. I don't want to be at the whip hand of like post-capitalism. I don't want to be putting dollars and cents in billionaires' bank accounts that don't pay their taxes. Like, this whole thing, I'm finding I've been happily out of this, and I wish you well, right?
Right.
But I, you know, let's just, yeah, kind of call it here, and I'll give you a meeting back. And he just looked at me and went, "Could you start tomorrow?" And I'm like, "I can't because I'm unemployed." But
you're weighing it in your head of being like, "I did just get all of it off my chest," and it's like not scared him.
Yeah,
and
really.
Do I go for this then?
And I wasn't even saying it to test the man, you know, Mr. Nils. I was just saying it because that's exactly where my head was, and I was quite tired, and I was just being really honest and candid. And he was like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Look, cool. You heard what I said." He's like, "I heard what you said." And they were amazing because they gave me freedom. They're the greatest gift you could give me personally. I can't speak for other people, is to back me and let me go and try and do the things that I believe in. And they really, really did that. Not just Nils, but Nat and Lucy as well. And we had a brilliant trust relationship where they appreciated my point of view on the world and my point of view on the world, the work and the style of work. And we really, really did push, especially in the early days, with quite experimental stuff, you know. Like, the collusion thing was probably the best thing I think I did there, and it was like right in the early days, you know. It was a social experiment, really. We cast 100 people turning 18 in 2018 and made a big documentary series out of them to launch a new fashion brand. You know, I wrote the first iteration of Britain Get Talking, you know, and there's that live moment, like stopping live TV, and we had the whole channel silenced for a month, and creating the platform and the language that lived underneath that. And it's just run and run and run. You know, it's amazing. H&M, One Second Suit, pitching and winning B&Q was just like a thing where, you know, I feel like at that point, about 2 years in, the whole industry was watching us, and B&Q came in, and, you know, I'm airing all the laundry here, so please, Paddy, Jamie, Becky, don't hate me. But I was like, why are we pitching B&Q?
I think a lot of people thought that, mm-hmm. though. Like, you were definitely not the only one to think that. And I think, yeah, like, it was kind of Chinese whispers of, like, mm-hmm. why are they doing that? That doesn't make sense.
What are they going to do?
Yeah.
And you know, I certainly asked the question, and Neil said, well, just, you know, write the work you want to make. And if they want that work, we'll win the pitch. And if they don't want that work, we'll lose the pitch. And that's okay, because they'll make the work they want to make, no hard feelings, but it won't be what we want. So we just wrote it and won it and then made that. And it was such an amazing, empowering thing to just say, let's back ourselves. And wherever that brand has been, right, we can take them somewhere amazing. Mm. And it just, we just have to hold hands and jump together. You know, they're gonna have to come with us, and we're gonna have to go somewhere really bold. Because if we don't go somewhere really bold, we'll just make something really shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel that was actually a pivotal moment at Uncommon, where we'd done some amazing work, but it tended to be for either startups, you know, like Habito, where, you know, you've got much more of a direct relationship with the founder, and you're unencumbered by tired old advertising of the past. You're just going from a clean slate, or really cool things like with ASOS or Nike or what have you. And, and we were kind of shiny, but we weren't tested against like a big old retail brand, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? With a dusty old kind of thing going on with the advertising. And, you know, they came to us, and in all fairness, like Paddy was, you know, Paddy Earnshaw, like shout out, amazing, amazing client, was like, look, we've lost our mojo. And we're like, mate, we got you, right?
Yeah.
And it was just, we just kind of attacked it with freshness and ambition and boldness and emotion. And, you know, that was a super amazing learning for me, which is back yourself. Be bold. Doesn't matter if you lose, then, you know, at least you put it all out there. And actually, some of that work, like the We Will Grow Again thing, you know, that whole campaign was so amazing, and it was so effective as well as being so emotional. And it wasn't a freaking story about flowers. It was a story about life and being locked up and unable to find hope and all of those things. And yet it was this amazing, like 60% year-on-year uplift, like highly effective ad campaign at the same time, you know. And it was such a lesson to me, which is like, actually, yeah, we'd all love to make a Nike ad, and it is great making a Nike ad, and Nike are amazing, and I love them, and hats off and shout out to them and all of that good stuff. But there is so many amazing Nike ads in a long line of amazing Nike ads. And when you make one, you've done something amazing. But look at the company that it's in.
Yeah.
When you come out of the gates and make a really amazing ad for B&Q, everyone's like, whoa, hang on, where did that come from? What? I didn't see that coming. And the surprise factor is so cool. And we got that with that kind of piece of work when it came out of the gates. And, you know, it was a big lesson to me to really cherish any brand, you know. Unless it's like an evil brand doing a bad thing, you know, yeah. like a petrochemicals or whatnot, or, you know, you can figure out the rest. Any brand can really do something amazing and human and powerful. They just need to be in that headspace where they really want to unshackle themselves, you know,
yeah,
and you know, take the leap.
Yeah, I think it's so important, the part of when you mentioned in the pitch, do the work you want to make, and if they don't want it, then we won't win, and that's fine. I think it's just not said enough, and it's not known enough, because there's...
It's punchy.
Yeah, but there's all these pictures of people going in to pitch the work that they think that the client wants, and then nothing ever changes, like you said.
Yeah, exactly, so, and why second guess? Because yeah, you don't know.
It's like having that freedom to be like, well, if they don't want it, that's fine, because someone else will, and we will find them. It's
go,
like,
go with your heart.
Yeah. Right?
And that was what they gave me, you know, the three of them. Which I'm eternally grateful. It was an amazing amazing ride, you know, and I'm tricky, so I wouldn't have been in the same boat with them for half a decade if we didn't have an amazing trust and understanding. But, you know, I also feel that sometimes you just have to find your next thing, and when you stop learning, what do you do then? And you know, like, I feel that we were an amazing Venn diagram, you know, me and Uncommon, and still are, and I still speak to them all regularly, that we're friends. But there's also a thing in my head that, well, it's not my voice there really, it is on project, but the vision of the agency, you know, like, there's a thing there, they stand for something.
Yeah, of course.
And I believe in what they stand for, but I believe in what I stand for even more, you know, because it's more personal to me. And, you know, hence, you know, taking some kind of wild plunge at the end of last year and leaving the best job in the best agency in town, you know.
Yeah, but I think, like, talk to me about that. Tell us all about Calling, like, your new agency. Yeah, we want to know it all, basically.
Yeah, okay, shameless plug. well, no, I mean, it is that. Like, I just became acutely aware of, you know, in the last year at Uncommon, really, especially, that, you know, the clock's ticking, and what am I really going to do with, like, the last chapter of my career? And I was so comfortable there and so trusted. But for me, I was also kind of, you know, scratching away at my own, I guess, personal view of the ad industry. And when Uncommon started, it was pre-pandemic, and 5 years ago is a long, long time, you know, in today's money, and the world's completely pivoted. And I really did feel that, and audiences have completely pivoted, and they want something different. And you know, I really felt that there was something in me that wanted to do something more radical, even than you know, the positioning for Uncommon when they came out, especially this thing around, you know, the argument that rages constantly, boring argument that rages constantly within, like, the campaign pages around, oh, are we sick of purpose? And, oh, can't we just get back to the old days and selling and, like, purpose this and blah, blah. Like, it's not even an argument anymore, right?
Yeah.
Because the world's moved on, audiences have moved on, and audiences, like, expect more from the brands that they associate with. I think it's as simple as that. If you ever get the amazing opportunity to see the Calling creds, it opens with some stuff, but really a stat, which is that 83% of consumers expect brands to stand for something other than profitability, right? And that's a mainstream concern now. People wanting brands to stand for something is not, we're not a purpose agency. It's not a niche concern. It's a mainstream concern. It's what people want. And do you know what? The more brands that I talk to, you know, the more meetings I sit in where people pop open a purpose deck that's been traveling around the building for a year or 2 years,
yeah,
because they've felt what audiences want first, and agencies are still playing catch up. And I'm like, really, I've got a radical agenda that I want to scratch out here, you know, which is to take all of the things that I'd pursued at Uncommon and double down on it, you know, and build an agency out of it, an agency that is built around culture and community and purpose in its output, but also an agency that has a different, you know, sort of spirit, you know. I think, you know, a more diverse in every sense kind of approach to the people that we bring in, you know. And I'm not just talking in terms of, you know, like, demographics or whatnot, but diverse in terms of kind of thought and outlook. And you know, I've always wanted to do this thing, like, to break the cult of the ECD and to not have loads of people come in that think they need to think like me. I just want the opposite. I want people that will come in and think completely differently to me and have a completely diverse outlook on the world, and find people who have their own calling and they want to express that through the work that we make. And so I was like, there is a new radical thing here somewhere, and I'm thinking culture, community, purpose, and that's the work. And I'm thinking a super diverse way of bringing in people, not only in terms of core crew, but can we build a collective out of it? Can we, like, have a fluid way of bringing in people with different lived experiences to influence the work from a really authentic standpoint? Like, we kick the authentic word around loads and loads and loads, and you can't really do it unless you've got the right voices, you know? Like, I really believe that, you know? I think it's different to the acting world, where it's like, oh, you you can't cast somebody who's not Jewish to play a Jewish person or something like that. I think you probably can, but within advertising, we're under so much scrutiny now.
Mm.
And advertising, you know, can either appropriate or celebrate other people's lived experiences, and you've got to get on the right line of that. And so that was eating away at me a little bit as well, you know, like a really kind of just blow the doors off diverse, kind of like weird that a white guy's saying this, but seriously, the only thing I can do right now is to give my fucking privilege away to other people and let people in. And that was burning away at me as well. And if it was my agency, I could do that. And similarly, so I could really do something that was born out of culture and purpose. And similarly, so I could really do something that was born actually to serve where I think today's consumers and today's brands need to point, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were born this year, right, to service humans that are thinking about life now. We weren't born 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You know, we were born now to do the shit that's important now, because shit right now is like in a really weird place. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's broken, and a lot of it needs fixing. And you know, the only way you're going to do that is if you're fit for purpose. A startup is completely unencumbered. We don't have to change all the stuff that's old. We don't have to convince people to do things a different way. We don't have to go and find Terry who is set in his ways and change their mind. And you know, that, well, that's labor. Mm. It's labor changing an agency. And our labor should be making the best works. That's really hard. It's really hard to make amazing work. It's really hard to do that at the same time as you're trying to dismantle and rebuild a machine. It's like nigh on fucking impossible. It's like a startup. You can come out of the gates. This is what we're going to do. This is what we stand for. Advertising with a higher calling. You know, work that means more, has more depth, and connects communities and cultures to the brands that they love, allows today's audiences to see themselves in the brands they love, you know, and that's a super important thing, like deeply, and find that human connection, you know, that's really kind of born of the times, you know, not born of our old perceptions of, you know, what this consumer used to be or that consumer used to be. And so for all of those reasons, you know, I've rambled, Molly, and I'm really aware of that. And I haven't said much that's succinct, but there were a lot of things that were boiling away in my mind. And for me, a startup was not just a way to answer what I think is a gap or a need in the market for brands, but also something to stretch out personally and to go like, how can I really give myself the biggest challenge possible? Because I mean, why not? You know, and I really think that, honestly speaking, London doesn't need another ad agency, you know, because there isn't enough work to go around for the ones that currently exist. We all know how hard it is to win a pitch. But London does need better agencies, you know, like it really does. I sometimes look at the work, I feel we're in the doldrums a bit, you know, and I know there's a lot of mitigating factors that might take us there, but I think we need freshness, you know, and credit to Uncommon, I think that's always what they brought, you know, boldness. And you know, how do we keep doing that? How do we keep pushing the envelope? Mm-hmm. You know, and keep looking for the thing that's new, right?
Yeah, and I think with the work that's already come out from Calling, it's just so apparent as well that is exactly everything that you've just summed up is exactly what you're then funneling into the work. You can just see it through and through. So yeah, thanks for running us through that.
Yeah, no worries. And I mean, that's it. I mean, no one's stopped us yet.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Always caveat that with a yet.
Yeah, it's really early days though. But again, and also like a chance to be idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that idealism's amazing, right? And big problems don't get solved with timid thinking. And, you know, I feel like radical steps are important. And cautious shuffling is not gonna fix stuff. So again, that's another reason to start a new business, you know, and try and come in and really do something that makes a leap. I really just hope we can do that. You know, that's the thing. We just gotta live up to our own ambitions, you know.
Exciting.
Mm-hmm. Excitement and terror are adjacent emotions.
Yeah, they very much are. I think I only learned that this year. And mm-hmm. you know, when you learn something and it makes the like so much sense in all aspects of everything. Yeah. I think I was...
It's the roller coaster feeling.
Yeah, I was in some...
I'm terrified, but I love it.
Yeah, it was mad. I was in some training or something and was like, oh my God, like my brain can't decipher which is which. And mm-hmm. that is why I feel it all at once, and I'm not really sure. Pivotal point in Molly Jennings' life right then, learning that. So as well, something that we do at Unknown is we've launched a workshop called Nobody Wants to Work for You. And I think it was because we were basically trying to understand why a lot of talent was leaving the industry, or why it was just less of this shiny, more like desirable place to be and to want to be and to want to create. And yeah, like, do you think that the industry's lost its charm? I think we've touched on this a little bit in what you've said previously, but how do you think that that sort of has played out in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, clearly, but first and foremost, advertising has given me and many people I know a really amazing experience in life, where we've been paid to use our imagination and to create things out of nothing, and to have all the variety of the different brands and the different challenges and the different briefs, and to be swept up in the tide of life a lot of the time, and to be expected to reflect changing societal moods. And it's a beautiful industry. Like, it really, really is. And it does need to reinvent itself, but let's not give it a real pasting, you know, let's just be positive about it. Are people less likely to want to work here? I think young people probably don't see themselves in this business. You know, I think they probably don't see themselves reflected in it. Certainly not in London, being an incredibly diverse, you know, one of the most diverse cities in the world. And I think that's probably at the heart of it. Because I think to love somewhere and to want to stay there, you need to feel safe. In order to feel safe, you need to feel like you belong. In order to feel like you belong, you need to feel that there's enough other humans like you that have a communal experience, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, I know everyone's pushing at fixing this, but I don't think it's happened fast enough. And I also feel that not only is the kind of, you know, on the ground demographics of this thing, you know, quite probably tough and in some ways exclusive still, you know, I think there's also still quite an old-fashioned hierarchical model that runs through advertising, and it is frustrating no matter how old and long in the tooth you get. It's always frustrating having to be running up the flagpole the whole time, and I think that younger people have so much to give, and we should be learning from them in a lot of ways. And of course you can't shoulder them with everything, because they can't bring the necessary experience all of the time to all of the tasks and all the problems, but really, like who's the boss here, and who's got the really valuable, insightful new thing to say? And is it necessarily the old people at the top? And I think there's a dual issue here between, you know, a need to flatten these hierarchies out and really make that young blood pump through the important parts of the organism properly, you know? And at the same time, I really feel that perhaps, you know, this sense of belonging, you know, can be missing for people. And I just think, you know what, everyone knows what I'm saying. You know, it's you know, it's not enough to hire just one or two people, you know what I mean? Because they're what? Like, where's their community? Yeah. Where is their community inside that organization? Right. And it is hard. It's really hard, and I sympathize. I think if you've got a 200 or 300 person agency, like, to affect that is, you know, well, how do we switch out 100 people for 100 new people? You can't really do it, you know, or not quickly. But do you know what? It is still, you know, an extremely beautiful industry. I mean, we get paid to use our imagination to think of the things that we think matter to us, bring them into the world and get paid for it. And get paid well, and, you know, the people are great, and, you know, the challenges are great, and the brands are great, and it is super cool. And it at its best, it still does remain relevant in culture sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the trash doesn't, but the best bits are relevant, and it's up to us to keep them relevant and make them relevant and really, really push to stay relevant.
Yeah. And I think it's like what you said, like, so many brands are under so much scrutiny now that they don't really have a choice. They have to be relevant, and they have to understand that to be relevant, you have to change things up, and you have to actually give platforms and voices to different types of people and like take that sort of leap. Like you said, what B&Q did, like they were probably the least likely brand ever to become relevant and have everyone talking about them, but they took the leap. So yeah, I think it's that, like, you can't hide now behind the advertising, I don't think, for brands.
Yeah, yeah. Or as Virginia Woolf said, you can't find peace by avoiding life. Mm-hmm. Right, it's that. You got to come out and make a stand, but you got to, but then your stand's got to be able to withstand scrutiny. It's a thing, Molly. You know, I feel that, oh, there's just not enough people from this background or community that have got the right experience, and that's why we can't do it. And I've heard all the excuses, and I just think that we have to get past that, and we have to hire the people we need to hire, right, to create that sense of belonging again for a contemporary cohort of young people coming into the industry. And that means investing in them. It doesn't mean just hiring them and going, oh, it didn't work. It means hiring and investing, teaching, mentoring, listening, going, how is this going to work out best for you? And I know I've got 20 other things to do today. I've got a client to placate and a script to write and a finance meeting to sit in and blah, blah, blah. But it's also super important we do this stuff too, because if we don't bed people in properly and listen to them and see them, you know, and create the conditions for them to feel that they belong, that's labor, right? Let's not pretend it isn't. And it's necessary labor. It's not going to happen by accident. And I feel that the answer is there, that, you know, that we need to invest as, oh God, fucking horrible word, as leaders or like older humans in advertising. We have to invest our labor into creating those conditions.
Yeah,
we have to really go, I'm going to hire the people I need to hire, for one, put the money where the mouth is, but then allowing them to enter the building is not enough. It's about really kind of figuring out how that's a nurturing experience. And do you know what? That will make that organization a more nurturing experience for everyone. You know, that have a ripple down effect, and brands will come and they'll be like, wow, this place is different. Like, it's kinder and more rounded and, you know, like more empathetic and, you know, more in touch and all of these great things, you know. But that it won't happen without the work.
Yeah. Amen. To that. And I do think that's where there's been, like, there has been progress, so much progress. It's such a different place now than it was. But I think a lot of that has been from people saying, we need to hire these people, bringing them in, and then not understanding how to utilize them, or not understanding actually, why have we brought you in? What are you here to do? What is your capabilities? Because a lot of people don't realize their potential unless it's kind of given to them in like a nurtured way. Like you mentioned before, you were given the opportunity to start writing. Like, you maybe would have never done that if someone didn't believe that you could do it. So I think there's always that level of like a nurture that is the most important part of it. Like you said, you can't just hire someone in and go, okay, go, off you go, start making.
It's a process.
Yeah, which is insane. And I think I always like the side of that you're so passionate about bringing younger people into the industry. It's so needed. I speak to so many talented young creatives and I'm just like, whoa, mind blown by a lot of them.
Yeah,
I think,
for real.
What do you think is the most important quality, skills, anything for young people to like double down on and focus on when trying to break into this weird and wonderful industry?
Having a voice. It's as simple as that. What do you care about? Look at the world and what do you care about? It's as simple as that. You know, like, no one can teach that. And it's the most powerful thing that you've got. Then if you don't really know how to write a good script, we can sort that out. You know, if you can't find a reference image for the ad you're trying to sell, we can sort all of that stuff out, you know. But it's about using your voice. I mean, that's what this industry really, really is about at its heart, and we shouldn't ever forget that. And, you know, it's like, what's your opinion on life, you know, and the world, and what's your axe to grind, you know? Bring that and get really clear and focused about it. And, you know, can figure out how to write a Manny together or whatever it is that maybe the craft gap, you know what I mean? That's teachable, you know. I can't teach you what your voice is. I bloody well shouldn't. It's dangerous, you know what I mean? It's at odds with people self-actualizing, and I feel that's it, you know. And that's a beautiful, you know, interaction every time. You know, it's a learning every time someone comes and says, this is what I believe in. Why? And they say, and then you go, why? And then they say, and then you go, why? And then they say, and you go, fuck, okay, I learned something, right? And that's something that, that we should all be doing all of the time, you know? And I feel like oftentimes it is younger people that teach you something new. I mean, it stands to reason.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm. So this is a section when we ask you to bring a stinky fish to the table, mm-hmm. something that you absolutely hate.
Yeah, it's a really easy one because it just burns in my head every day. I fucking hate our government. I fucking hate the Tories. Fucking burn them. Like, really, honestly. I know I probably shouldn't say this, but like, I don't know. I feel that there's such a gross unfairness that has unfolded in front of everybody. And I just, it breaks my heart. Like, we now have a prime minister who profited tens of millions of pounds during a pandemic because he'd invested in a hedge fund that he knew was buying shares in Moderna, and then all of a sudden the government ends up buying loads of Moderna vaccines that never got used, and as people were dying in their tens of thousands, he was getting rich beyond anybody's wildest dreams in this crazy cost of living crisis. His wife is a non-dom like tax exile until she got found out and then decided that she better bloody pay her taxes. And he now runs our country on a policy of not paying our doctors and nurses or our teachers or anybody, you know? And I'm just like, what has this country become when it's actually, I think, corrupt now, almost in plain sight?
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart. It just the unfairness of it, you know, and the uneven distribution of the wealth and resources that we all need, that we all deserve. I just honestly, that kind of want rid. You know who I'd be voting for, like, come 2024. But I feel like, you know, it's an integrity thing, you know, and where is the integrity now? Where the people that are running our country, I'm pretty certain, are using their position of government to further create their own personal wealth and power. And do you know what? It would be less problematic if this country was in really great shape, but it's not, mm-hmm. in any way, shape or form, you know. And it really does grind my gears, you know. Everywhere you go, you know, you just see the effects of the past 13 years, you know, in the hospital, in the school, and on the bloody trains, like everything. Yeah, that, there you go, smelly old rishi fishy.
That was a big old stinky fish.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Fair though. I mean, yeah, I have nothing to add. I think you articulated that pretty damn well.
Yeah, but yeah, they've done us a mischief and somebody else needs to have a go now.
Yeah. Mm. Soon come 2024. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really, yeah, enjoyed chatting with you. Thanks for coming along.
Yeah, no, thank you. What a pleasure.
Amazing.